all about the pendants, baby.
Hello, IT. Have you tried turning it off and on again?
To start, press any key. Where's the any key?
Excuse me. I believe you have my stapler.
Welcome to We Are Technologies User Friendly with host Bill Sickens, technology architect.
And I am your host, Bill Sickens. This is User Friendly. Welcome to this week's show. We've got a great lineup for you this week, but first, check us out online. We have a new website for the season, userfriendlyshow.com. Become part of the show. Send us your ideas. Send us your questions. Listen to our podcasts. We even have season one up online for you to take a look at from 4 years ago to see where this all started. Userfriendlyshow.com, or if you prefer, Twitter, Facebook, One User Friendly. There are other user friendlies out there, but we are number one. One User Friendly on Twitter. One User Friendly on Facebook. Join the conversation. Get involved. So today we've got a great lineup for you. We've got a segment on video game systems, a retrospective of where this all came from, going back and looking at some of the Ataris and where Nintendo started and where and how we got to today. Our guest, Warky, her host from San Jose, is going to be on to talk about the Internet of Things show that occurred this week down in San Jose, talking about some of the new devices and some of the new technologies that we're going to see for smart homes and everything else. Internet of Things show. Our own Mr. Movie, Gary, is going to be on to review Alien Covenant. Is it a great new Alien movie or does it flop at the box office? He's going to tell us all about it. And speaking of flops, we are going to be looking back at the last year and a half of tech flops. We talk a lot about new technology on this show and what makes it and how it works in our lives. But for every product that comes out that's successful, there's a couple that just don't make it. It's going to be interesting to look through that list and see what there has been. And finally, joining me on the show today is our game editor and host, Bill Snodgrass, who is putting together some in-depth podcasts. Bill, welcome to the show and tell us a little bit about what you are doing with your podcasts.
Thank you, Bill. The idea with the podcast, User-Friendly Games, is that I only get a few moments to talk about games here on the show. And as you guys know, I can talk about games for days. Moving forward, we're not only going to go more in-depth into the reviews here on the show, but also cover games that we don't have time to cover on the radio at all. That being said, we're also going to expand into video podcasts, do some unboxings and gameplay footage of tabletop and RPG games. And farther on, we're even going to bring in some guests, have some fun with them, play games, talk with creators, designers, dungeon masters, and the like, and possibly even do some video game footage.
Bill, thank you so much, and we look forward to that. And again, Bill's first podcast is up and online already. Userfriendlyshow.com, click on podcasts, and click on the Bill Snodgrass Gaming In-Depth link. We will be back after the break. Welcome back to User Friendly, userfriendlyshow.com, One User Friendly on Facebook and Twitter. Check us out. Our next topic today is actually something that has been of great interest to me as I've been a collector of these things over the years, and that's video games. Now, Bill Snodgrass has reviewed a number of games on the show with us, and what he's been talking about like on the last week's show was a retrospective of some games that are coming out for the PS4 that were out before.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it's kind of cool to really see where these things came from, but I don't think anybody really knows the origin of all this stuff and the fact that video games almost did not make it out to where they are today.
Well, I remember Pong.
Yeah, Pong.
I remember Merlin.
Well, Pong was a
Pong was a little
doohickey you plugged into the TV.
Yeah, and it wasn't little.
No, well, it was four versions of Pong. It was like tennis, table tennis, and but it was still you had a thing on the side, bounced a little ball,
going bing.
And
bing.
I remember that plugging that into the TV and thinking, wow, this is kind of cool.
Oh, we wasted hours playing that.
Yeah.
And then they came out with the little handheld things like Merlin, which looked like a telephone. Yeah. And then they had the little football games, and they even had a basketball one. I had the baseball one because I actually understood how baseball worked.
I remember that. Well, did you know that there's actually eight different generations of video games?
Wow, no, I didn't know that.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's gone through cycles, and the very first idea of a home video game was actually conceived in 1951.
Really?
So this is not something that is brand
1951?
New.
1951?
And the first systems that you actually could take home and connect started appearing in the late 60s.
Oh.
Huh.
So I know that the very first one that I got when I was growing up that I had found, a garage sale or flea market or something, was called something called a Fairchild Channel F.
Hmm. I haven't heard of that one.
And no. This was a system. It was all a wood grain cabinet of the era and all that type of thing. It had controllers that was like a puck you held in your hand and the top part turned. I don't believe it had fire buttons or anything on it, but it was actually the very first system that came out that took cartridges.
Okay.
And the cartridges looked like an 8-track tape.
So it was before the Atari?
It was before the Atari.
Okay.
And it was actually in the generation of something. Magnavox had a system at that time called the Odyssey.
I remember
that
one.
Yeah, they had released it in 1972. And Jeremy, very likely what you remember was the Odyssey 2.
Probably. But
the Odyssey 2 is the one that took cartridges. The original Odyssey didn't.
Oh, okay. No, I remember the cartridges. So it was 2.
So these early systems like the Odyssey and the Fairchild, and it was very innovative to actually have cartridges that could expand your games.
Oh, yeah.
But built into them would be basic things like you were talking about Pong,
mm-hmm.
and those type of things would have come with it. There was a version of Breakout that was mm-hmm. on a lot of these. The Odyssey 100 had a hockey game, and the Odyssey 200 had some additional features where you could actually have up to 4 players. They had a game called Smash that came with the higher-end system. And Atari at that time released their original console, I guess you would call it Pong, through Sears stores. And that was a special that you would actually go to Sears and it'd be where you buy it. And it would plug into your TV, but it was just a Pong.
Yeah.
And that's all it did. Very, very popular. In fact, the original Pong, when it was put into, at that time they didn't have them yet, but what was going to become an arcade, I believe it was a restaurant or something that it was put in. And 3 days later, the proprietor of the restaurant said, come and pick this thing up. It doesn't work. So when they came back to check on it, what it actually ended up being was that the thing was so full of quarters that it actually jammed the coin intake unit.
Oh, man. Awesome.
So, it was definitely something. And when they saw that, they said, you know, we actually have something on our hands that would be successful. So that was what was considered the first generation. And the first generation was 1970 through 1972, rather, through approximately 1980.
Okay, that makes sense.
So from that, you saw your first home consoles. The Fairchild Video System, the Channel F that I was talking about, was originally released in 1976. Hmm. There were 2 versions of it. Both took the same cartridges. The newer one was a little bit smaller. The Atari, original Atari system that took cartridges was the Atari 2600, originally released under the name of the Video Computer System, VCS.
Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah.
And that had a number of different generations on it. That would be considered the start of the second generation of consoles.
That makes sense.
And was certainly by far the most popular one.
Right up to E.T. Right.
I remember the Atari one that had the joystick, and you'd play for so long that your hands hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the 2600.
Yeah,
that was the 2600. And to compete with that, there were actually a couple of other ones that came out. The RCA Studio 2, the ColecoVision.
I loved that.
The ColecoVision. And the ColecoVision had a lot stronger graphics.
Yes, it did.
It was more your arcade quality. The Atari 2600 was very...
pixelated?
Basic, let's just say. And again, your memory and all that type of thing was very, very limited when these came out. The ROM cartridge, all of that type of a thing was nowhere near what we have now, or you know, even close. So when they started upgrading, you had the same progression in computers. So the ColecoVision and the other one that was the Mattel system, which was the Intellivision.
I remember that one too.
Both came out a little bit later and both were a little bit stronger. And then Atari's answer to that was a model called the 5200.
I remember one of those, but I didn't have it, and I didn't know anybody who did.
Yeah, they were very short-lived. I had one. Getting that together was a very difficult thing to do. But its problem was its controllers didn't work very well.
Ah, that's so terrible.
So after you would take it out of the box brand new and use it for a couple of hours, you'd actually wear out the joysticks.
Oh, you're kidding.
So there were some other products that were released to try to fix that, but it was just never very good. But what happened is actually an interesting story, because Atari is a company that went from being very successful to going out of business very quickly. And a lot of speculations out there as to why. But basically what ended up happening is they quit making good games.
Yeah, E.T. was a terrible well, video game.
E.T. also is an interesting story because for whatever reason, Atari decided to make more cartridges of E.T. than there were systems that existed.
Yeah, that's one of those things.
That's kind of odd.
In fact, I think it was 2015 that they actually went and dug them up out of the
They
dump.
Did, and one of them still worked.
Yep, one of them still worked. They had literally buried them. In a dump in it was New Mexico or Arizona or something, and they were actually able to dig them out, and these cartridges do still exist, but that's what would happen there. And it was kind of too bad, because when Atari came to an end, this portion of the video game market did along with it.
Your home video systems changed.
And they did those really nice stand-up arcade, and then those kind of went away too, didn't they?
Yeah, they sold their intellectual property, and it just you can still find a lot of their games available. But the original Atari system, that's what happened to it. So the 5200 wasn't made for a very long time. They had another model after that called the 7800 that took the 2600 cartridges. The idea was that it would be backward compatible, so your library would still work.
Cool.
And they did a couple of other things, including a handheld system and some other stuff like that. But unfortunately, never really were able to get back into the market, and finally were bought out, and that was the end of that. And when this happened... in North America was about 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was assumed by all of these companies that that was the end of video games. The market had crashed, the E.T. fiasco, all the rest of that kind of thing. It was just done. And at that point, most of your game consoles that were made in North America were discontinued, including Intellivision and ColecoVision and that type of a thing.
Huh.
Atari at that point had a home computer division. Both an 18 and 16-bit version. The different computers stayed around for a little bit longer, the ST being the one that kind of survived the longest from all of that. But eventually all of that went away too. And then you got into the third generation, which was actually a risk. And the name that came on the market at that point that we all know now today, in fact, Warky was covering their new system a few weeks ago, is the Nintendo.
I loved my Nintendo Game Boy.
And and in fact, I think you still have one, don't you?
I still have the original one. No, I gave away the very first one I had to another family that had needed one. But I have the first one. It was a black and white screen, or you know, green and black, whatever colors those were. But the case is clear.
Oh yeah,
clear plastic, so you can see the guts.
It looks cool.
I love that thing. I can still play the games on it. I have that one. I have the color one, and I have a 3DS.
So, and it, you know, it's interesting because when the Nintendo first came out, it wasn't even in North America.
Oh yeah, I know.
It was introduced under the name Family Computer or Famicom in Japan. And they actually called it a family computer because they didn't want to use the name video game system because it had such a bad reputation at the time.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
That's where that comes from.
Huh.
And it was originally designed to do a lot more than just play video games. The original control set is, for example, had a microphone that went away very quickly, wow. But that was in it. And then when it finally did come to North America, it was packaged in a way that was, again, the idea of it doing a lot more. It included a thing called Rob the Robot. In fact, I have that in my collection. There was a power glove and all kinds of other things.
The power glove is one of those holy grail collectible things. If you can find one, oh my God.
Yeah, they are out there, but they are very difficult to come by, especially one that is in good condition, you know. But the Nintendo, the original system ended up being a very good product at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. You could get games that you could play in the arcade.
You could get actual games that you could play in the arcade. It introduced some of our franchises that we still have this day, like Super Mario Brothers, which of course kind of set it afoot. The Legend of Zelda, which was mm-hmm. the first cartridge. They were a gold cartridge because they actually saved your game position.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going through all that. It had a physical battery in the cartridge, which was great until the battery went dead and you lost all of your games.
Oh.
And they would last about 2 years, and then you went through this process where you sent it to Nintendo. They'd take it apart at the factory, replace the battery. And but it was really something that you hadn't seen before, that kind of technology that was out there, and everybody and their brother started making games for the 8-bit Nintendo. Mm-hmm. Huge library, beat out Atari and Sega and all the rest of that very, very quickly.
I remember some school bus trips where like three or four kids had Nintendo Game Boys, and we just write your name on the back of the cartridge. And I played like, you know, five other kids' different cartridges because I'd never seen them.
Yeah,
it was so much fun. I mean, you know, just at the end of the trip, it's like, okay, I'm still missing this one. Oh, there it is. Cool. And, you know, everybody gave everybody's card back, and it was really fun.
Well, the Game Boy also introduced a feature where you could actually plug into another Game Boy over a cable. I remember Tetris.
I Tetris'd the heck out of several people on that bus trip.
But you actually had multiplayer mode with that.
Mm-hmm. It was fun.
Networking capability back in that era was very, very unusual.
Before cell phones and all that other stuff, yeah.
I mean, at that time, we didn't even really have commerce-based Ethernet or any of that kind of stuff, too. So the ability to connect them together was kind of a big deal. So some of the competitors to Nintendo, which never really terribly went far. The Sega Master System, I did have one of those at one time. Interesting. I think the graphic capability was actually a little bit better, but never really took off in North America. It did pretty well in Europe. You see them out there still. The next generation Sega, which did better here, called Mega Drive, in North America, Genesis.
I remember Genesis. Okay.
And that came with a game I remember called Altered Beast.
Yeah, I remember that one. That was a cool game in the arcade.
Yeah, it was really cool. And it talked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had some of that. I mean, Intellivision had this big module you plugged into the side to get some voice. But this one actually talked. I mean, that was a big, big deal at the time. And Atari was still on the scene then. They repackaged their, what was an 8-bit home computer, something called an XEGS game console. Who has one of those?
I remember the Jaguar.
Yeah, the Jaguar was
the portable one?
That was their portable.
Okay.
And you had the Commodore 64 at the time. Commodore tried to make a game system. Later went on to the Amiga. They went out of the market in the early 90s. So handhelds, like you're talking about there, Game Boy, now the Nintendo DS, and they've continued building on that technology because it's been quite successful.
Well, yeah.
And it's something that...
The 3DS doesn't play the original Game Boy games, but that's why I've kept the color one that I have. It was a blue one. But it's a flip screen, but I can still play, you know, Moon Patrol and Joust and old classic video games that I grew up with that I really, really like.
Those were really popular in the arcades.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that took us into fourth generation, which is kind of the cycle we've been in since then. So fourth generation is guessed to have started about 1987. From that, we got the Super Nintendo.
I still have mine.
Yep, and I remember at the time, the graphics, it was just the 16-bit, boy, was that a difference.
Well, that was the stuff, like, I remember playing stuff in the arcades and then going home and playing that same-looking game on my Super Nintendo.
Yeah, and it just...
Oh, that's so cool.
It was... And keep in mind, we still, at this era, didn't have high-definition TV or anything like that.
Or cell phones.
But it was definitely a big upgrade. NEC tried to come onto the market with a product called TurboGrafx 16.
I remember that one.
I do remember that system. I had one of those for a little while. They actually ultimately didn't do too well on the console, so they tried to re-release it as a handheld system because it used these little cards with the game programs on it. Never went very far, but it was out there. TurboGrafx, I remember it. It was some of what it could do. I think it had a little bit more powerful processor. So the updates and animation capability and stuff did beat out the Nintendo, but it never took off. And Mega Drive, again, the Sega Genesis, as we would have had it in North America, was the biggest competition to that. That actually did do a little bit better, actually did a lot better than the Master System. And they were able to do some different things with that you didn't see. But again, Nintendo had the market, and they had the franchises. Mm-hmm. You want to play Super Mario Brothers to this day, you have to have a Nintendo. So, you know, it's interesting. The Super NES kind of held it for a long time. You had games on that like Castlevania and some different things like that. On the Sega end of it, they came out with a CD drive.
Yeah, it was Sonic.
And you had a lot more storage capability with that. TurboGrafx actually did have a CD. I've never actually seen one, but I know that they are out there. And that's what came to the next generation of this, which actually created a very interesting product. And at the time, two companies that are very much competitors now got together to build a system that was going to be the replacement for the Super Nintendo. And it actually is a product that was manufactured, never really sold, called the Nintendo PlayStation.
Oh, no.
They just found one of these last year in a box.
Branded Nintendo.
A branded Nintendo.
Oh, my.
With a CD-ROM thing on it. So it took the Nintendo cartridges and played the Sony PlayStation CDs.
Oh, my. That's intense.
And from what I understand, I'll put a link up on our social media because there's actually a special podcast that was done on restoring this thing. And
that is so cool.
They go through and they actually did get it working for the most part. I don't know if they got the CD part working, but they did get the cartridge reader working. So it's a very interesting thing that's out there. There are pictures of it. Such a thing did exist. It's been talked about. But from that, we ended up with the next generation of the Nintendo. Nintendo 64.
Oh, that's right.
And then GameCube. So Nintendo 64 and the Sony PlayStation. And the two companies went very different directions and are now competitors. And what came out of that is the PlayStation, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, and now PlayStation 4. The original PlayStation took CDs only. PlayStation 2 took DVDs. And then the newer ones have all been Blu-ray.
Is that why they're not backward compatible?
That's an interesting question.
They should have been.
And it's actually one that at one time some of them were. So the PlayStation 3, the original very first release of that, played PlayStation 2 games. And then they removed the feature.
That's a bit bad idea.
And the Sony's explanation for that was they wanted to upgrade the onboard BIOS and some other things and just decided to stop making it backward compatible. PlayStation 4 does not play PlayStation 3 games unless you get one that's a port. You can download it and sometimes buy a different version, but it's not directly backward compatible. But the third competitor on the market now, bringing us into the modern era, is of course Microsoft.
And yes,
the Xbox. And you know, I don't know what's going on there with their naming conventions, but you had the Xbox 360, and then the Xbox One, which is the newest one.
Well, at least they didn't go for like 180, 920, 755, you know, weird things.
Where does the Wii fit into this?
Well, the Wii is a release from Nintendo that came out to compete with the PS3 era.
Oh, okay.
And the Wii, Nintendo and its recent consoles, or really all of them, has always been very innovative. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's not so good. The Wii, when it came out, introduced us to motion gaming. So the controllers had the gyros. You could move around and do different things.
I really liked that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I still to this day like it. We still have a Wii and still use it. And it's been cool. And then to try to double down on that, they came out with the Wii U.
I did not like that.
That had that tablet controller thing. So, but now, again, backward compatible, so that was nice. One of the things that the Wii lacked was the capability of outputting high-definition graphics.
Yeah, I understand. But so, I mean,
you know, so Wii U was trying to correct that. But the thing of it is again, the Wii U console just never took off. So now today we have the Nintendo Switch, which I think looks really cool. And again, Warky was talking about that, Warky and Preston, a couple of weeks ago. And it is actually a scenario where it's a handheld and a television console in one, and it seems to work. I think that their Achilles heel is the fact that it lacks software.
Well, yeah, it only came out with 10 games when they brought it out to market.
So,
and I remember looking at the store thinking, oh, cool, I can get some games for the Switch. And then the packaging that they had didn't tell me what the game was.
Yeah, they've had some very interesting things. They do seem to be selling, and it's too soon to really know. I think the capability is there. I think that it really features some unique things. They've had some problems. One of the controllers kept dropping off their Bluetooth connection and some things like that. There was some problem with the screen. I know they've been able to fix a lot of that through software updates. I'm not sure how you'd fix a problem with the screen that way, but it seems to have happened. But it's going to be, you know, interesting to see where that goes. Some of the other things that we're seeing now on the PlayStation 4, they have the VR, which is really, really cool. It's
going to be the next step. It really is.
It is. It's a $500 investment. So it's not cheap on top of the price of the console. So you're looking at dropping almost $1,000 to get the console, the VR headset, a few games for it, the controllers, the camera, and all the other things that you need. But from what Warky has said and from everything that I've heard, it's worth it. If you can afford it, it's definitely a definitely
I've tried out some of the VR, just the viewing things, and it's an amazing environment.
Yeah, the technology is absolutely immersive, and It's, you know, definitely a different topic, but to look at the different things that are out there for it. But the one that goes for the PS4 is really quite cool.
Awesome.
So now the Xbox, Microsoft is looking at doing some upgrades like that as well. They have an augmented reality headset.
Okay.
That they're working on. And so the difference between virtual reality is completely immersive.
Yes.
So it changes the environment around you. Augmented reality adds to the environment around you. So you're still seeing your room, but you're seeing kind of almost like a HUD type situation.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, a heads-up display thing.
So it's going to be interesting to see where that goes. It's also supported by Windows 10 and some of the other technologies that they're coming out with. But I haven't heard a lot about that lately. It was last fall. I know that they showed it off at E3 last year and at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas in January. But again, we'll have to see where that goes. It's also supported on Skype. I'm not quite sure what you do with a VR headset there, but that's where it
VR
is.
VR and Skype seems like a kind of redundant kind of thing.
Yeah, or again, augmented reality. In
their
case.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
we'll see.
Their product is called the HoloLens, and
I've heard of that one.
That's a Microsoft
cool.
product.
Cool. Okay.
So,
yeah. Okay.
So it's you know, again, it's going to be interesting to see where all this goes, and we'll come back and visit all that. But that's a really quick rundown on where our modern PS4 and Xbox One and all of that came from.
I think I learned something.
So, oh no. We'll be back after the break.
Alien Covenant is the sequel to Ridley Scott's Alien prequel, Prometheus. This one's set a few years after the Prometheus disaster. Colonists in stasis are on their way to a new planet. A space shockwave requires Walter, who's a clone of Prometheus's android David, to wake up the crew. While awake, they receive a strange signal. It's a John Denver song, Deep in Space. Unable to resist the mystery, the crew finds the source of the song is a planet that appears perfect for life. In fact, it may even be a better planet than where they're headed. But this is an alien movie, and this is science fiction, and that puts you a step ahead of the poor souls sucked into the trap. And it is a trap. The planet turns out to be infested with aliens and one other, even more dangerous, villain. Much more detail, and I'm giving away key surprises that really aren't surprises. It's an alien movie, so you pretty much already know it turns out bloody and badly for all involved. Michael Fassbender kind of reprises his Prometheus role. Catherine Waterston, Billy Crudup, and Danny McBride co-star. This is Scott's third alien movie, so it's whether in a spaceship or on a distant planet, he has the dark, gritty alien landscape down. But his characters are required to more or less sleepwalk through the plot, and like pieces on a chessboard, they end up exactly where they need to be. That's a limitation. It's a limitation, but as in with the original Alien and the recent Martian show, that limitation means he's still a great storyteller, even when his movies are bad, and Prometheus and Exodus Gods and Kings comes to mind. At least Scott's films are entertaining. When it comes to Alien Covenant, the good news for Scott is Prometheus is so bad that there's nowhere to go but up, and this one is up. Unfortunately for Scott, it's not up by much. I'm Gary Wolkoff.
Welcome back to User Friendly. Check us out online. We have a new website for the season at userfriendlyshow.com. Got a lot of stuff out there. Go on, check it out. You can submit your own story ideas, give us feedback, ask questions, or listen to the shows. Userfriendlyshow.com, social media, One User Friendly on Facebook, One User Friendly on Twitter.
Well, looks like our topic here has an interesting list of items, and you're going to tell us about tech flops?
So we're actually looking back the last 18 months at some of the technology that didn't make it, or certainly made a splash in one way or another, probably a little bit different than the manufacturer or inventor had hoped.
Oh, I see.
So number 10 on our list of 10 tech flops is United Airlines. So we've seen them in the news a lot on some other topics here. So this is an interesting one that we actually found out about when we were flying back east earlier in the year. And it turns out that United has decided that they're not going to be putting screens on the planes anymore for things like watching movies, the screen that's in the back of your seat, because, quote, everybody carries their own device, end quote. So I don't know if that's even entirely true, but assuming that it is the one little detail that we found out about this is if you have an Android device, it only works with Android version 4 or older.
That's quite a while ago.
Yeah. Well,
Android 4 was originally released in October of 2011 and was retired in November of 2014.
Jeez.
So if you have a device that was manufactured after November of 2014, it will not work with United's in-flight program. And according to the United Magazine and their press office, they are working on fixing this, but it looks like they've been working on fixing that for about the last year and a half. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. So I would suggest don't remove the screens until you actually can support everybody's device that supposedly everybody carries. Making our list as number 9 are the Karma drones. Now, this is a product that you may or may not have heard about. If you did, it was probably in a very strange way. And what this was is a product by GoPro.
Okay.
And they were trying to enter the market with their own drones. The only problem is they'd be up in the air for 10 minutes and due to an error in the programming would lose power.
Uh-oh.
And a GoPro camera, Hero 5, which is what's currently on the market now, they're great at that. But it seems like maybe stay out of the drone space because when you have your $500 camera on your $1,000 drone crash.
Yeah,
those things can't auto-gyro down.
Yeah, it is just...
That sounds awful.
Just a thing. So product that was taken off the market about 60 days after it was put out.
Ooh.
Number 8 on our list is the Microsoft Band 2.
What's that?
That's a good question. I had to look it up myself.
Oh.
It is the attempt to redo the Microsoft Band.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, I've never heard of a band. Oh, I heard of the Zune and how markedly successful that was.
Yeah, it's because we just talked about it earlier. No, the Microsoft Band was a competitor for the Fitbit.
Oh.
And there's two different versions that have been attempted over the last couple of years, the Microsoft Band 2 being the most recent of that. The device was bulky. Like the Zune, it didn't have all the same features and retailed for a much higher price point than the Fitbit or Apple Watch or any of the other competitors out there that did the same type of thing. Microsoft has said that they are not going to be working on a Band 3, which is probably
a good idea.
Yeah, it's probably better that they focus on what they're good at.
So Microsoft not only makes our list once, but twice here in the Microsoft forced Windows 10 upgrade from last summer.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. We need a sad trombone noise here.
Oh, we really actually do. It is. this has been something that was so incredible that people were actually calling the upgrade malware towards the end of the
I remember that.
Upgrade cycle because of this.
I still didn't like Windows 8. I thought that was the malware.
Yeah, well, Windows 8, I mean, they did need to have a replacement. And of course, for anybody that doesn't know, they skipped version 9 and just went straight to 10 for whatever reason. They haven't completely addressed that yet.
I still consider 10 to be 9.
Most people do. But to use their name for it, for about a year before it cut off back last July, Windows 10 was offered as an upgrade, and then finally really offered as an upgrade, and then finally forced as an upgrade. So it put itself on a lot of computers. You could back it back out. You had to turn it off, but there were constant pop-ups and different things that would be out there, and it was definitely something that was not met well by the majority of users.
Hmm.
So next on our list is one of actually three items that was a product that was so hot it caught on fire last year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that gets that drum roll thing, yeah.
And the first one of those coming in at number 5 is Samsung washers. Now, I'm not sure, did they blow up or did they catch on fire or did they do both?
They did both.
Okay, good. So at least we have multiple features.
Kaboom.
I don't know what it was with that, but
I feel so bad for them because I like their TVs and I like my phone, you know.
The tablets are pretty good too.
Well, and you know, the thing about Samsung is actually most of their products, 95% of them, 100% up to this really, are very good. High quality. I've used a lot of their things from computer monitors to smartphones to everything else over the years. And it just seems like last year they had a bad year. With these type of things happening, but having your washing machine potentially blow up was not something that people liked, and they've did a recall, and I think more or less have gotten it straightened out now, but it took about 6 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, just not something you want to have with your brand. And that brings us to the next item on the list, which is also something that caught on fire, and that was something called the Intel Basis Peak.
Okay, I've never
heard of that one.
Well, most people haven't, because it was only on the market for 45 days. The Basis Peak was a device by Intel that was going to be an entry into the smartwatch market.
Oh.
The only problem is it also overheated and burned your arm.
Oh, God, that would have been scary.
Nope.
And in an attempt to fix it, they sent out a software update and another one and another one. And finally, after about 6 weeks, determining that the only way to really prevent this item from overheating and burning your skin was to send an update that would not allow it to turn on. So that was the end of the device.
So that was a forced shutdown?
Basically, they were all returned. If someone still has one of these, they can contact Intel to figure out how to get it back. But yeah, it was something pulled from the market very quickly because, again, you don't want your smartwatch to be quite that hot.
It seemed like a really strange device for Intel to make. I thought they just focused on the guts, you know?
Yeah, Intel does make a lot of devices and these type of things over the years they have. Their primary thing, of course, is processors. That's what they do well. Working for them for a little while, a number of years ago, we were in a business lab where we did work on some other things. And they do a lot of their own motherboards and other components.
Yeah.
But it just seems like the smartwatch market was probably not the best direction for them to go, at least not yet.
Like I said, they seem like they're a company that works on the guts of machines, you know?
So, yeah. And again, a product they do well, but some of the other things, not so much. All right, next on our list at number 4, I don't know if anybody remembers a smart device called the Pebble.
Wasn't that part of the Fitbit thing?
It was bought by Fitbit.
Okay.
So yeah, you're right. Fitbit bought them and was going to do all this stuff with them, and I don't know that you can still buy a Pebble.
I thought a Pebble was a phone.
So did I.
It was a flip phone actually about 15 years ago, yeah.
Oh.
This Pebble was a smart wearable smart device. And Fitbit bought the company that made them and was going to do all of this stuff with them. And it seems, at least today, that it has just simply spun down that division and no longer manufactures those products. The Fitbit product itself is very good, so the expansion, again, just didn't seem to make a lot of sense.
I see.
All right, coming in at number 3 is the Apple AirPod.
Oh, yes, your wireless headphones.
Wireless headphones.
Yeah.
And when the iPhone 7 came out, where they removed the headphone jack, it was going to be the end of the world. And even though it didn't turn out to be, the Apple AirPods have been an interesting product. They were late to come out. So when the phone did come out without the headphone jack for a while, you didn't have a way to have wireless headphones outside of Bluetooth. And when it finally did appear, people are losing their headsets.
They lost a lot of them.
You have to charge each side. They're small, yeah. So they tend to disappear and that type of a thing. It's a product that's still on the market, and a lot of people that have them do like them, and they've kind of gotten better, but certainly was not the fix to the, as they called it, 34-year-old technology of a headphone jack. Sometimes
there's nothing wrong with that technology, though. Yeah.
Sometimes the old saying of it, if it isn't broke, don't fix it, which holds true here.
Yeah.
So on the new version of the iPhone, of course, you can now connect old-style analog headphones using an adapter for the Lightning port that's included with the phone, at least to this point. My understanding is in the next version, they're no longer going to include the adapter.
Huh. See, I think they should keep the flexibility. So if you're somebody who likes the cord, keep the cord. Those who don't want it can go get rid of it.
Well, and you know, the other thing that I found interesting about this is Apple had said that the reason they were removing the headphone jack was to have space in the phone for other things.
I don't think they did that.
Well, there is videos of this online that you can see, but the phone, of course, was taken apart right after it came out.
Oh, yeah.
And the only thing that's in the space where the headphone jack used to be is a piece of plastic.
Yeah, that's well used.
So that would be there. Now, one other word of advice on this. If you see online that you can drill a hole in your phone to put the...
I saw those videos and thought they were very entertaining.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. That is absolutely not true, and it does void your warranty, and you don't get your headphone jack back. So That is that's not the way to go. But Apple AirPods, interesting technology, something that is either really liked or really hated, still on the market. I also understand that their purchase price was well over $100 too.
Yeah.
So there you are. Number two, tech failures, is the Yahoo hack of last year.
Uh-huh.
Where millions of account information got out, and it was actually Yahoo hack 2.0 in many ways because it had already happened once. We just hadn't been told about it until last year.
Yeah, that's kind of cruddy.
Yeah, it's a little late to the show.
So if you haven't already, change your Yahoo password. It's very interesting to see where this goes with the Verizon merger and all of that that's going on right now. I don't know what's in store future for Yahoo, but they still do the email. And if you still use their system and you haven't changed your password recently, just good practice on anything. But definitely want to do it on Yahoo. Anybody can guess what our number one? So another product that was on fire, the Samsung Note 7.
Yeah, with a boom.
With a boom. And with the Galaxy S8 phone that came out this year, one of the advertising topics was the device does not catch fire, not something you want to have to use when you sell your product.
You can always say it's really hot, but it doesn't burn.
Yep. That's bad. So Jeremy will be applying to Samsung marketing.
Yes.
Call us, we'll call you. Anyway, the Samsung Note 7 was so bad that back in August and September, they did a recall, came out with a second version of it. Those caught fire as well. Ended up getting banned from planes and a number of other things. Completely no longer supported. They finally just brought them all back in and exchanged them for other devices that did work. And definitely an example of what happens when you rush a product to market and don't completely test it.
Check your battery.
One of the funniest things I saw on this is a little sketch from The Simpsons where Homer is in front of a whiteboard with the schematic and he's figuring out that you need to remove the TNT component and then maybe the phone won't blow up.
Yeah, that's always handy.
Actually a battery problem and definitely not something you want with your brand. So those are our top 10 tech flops of the last 18 months.
Yeehaw.
User Friendly will be back after the break.
Welcome back to the show. This is Bill Snodgrass, and I'm only stepping in for a second to remind you, look us up on userfriendlyshow.com, One User Friendly on Facebook and Twitter. Leave us your comments and questions and ideas. Up next, I'm handing this over to our friends from California, Steve Warkey Nunez and Preston Cowley, who went to the IoT World Conference. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hi there. Thanks for having us. Preston and I did indeed go to the IoT World, or Internet of Things World Conference, in beautiful Santa Clara, California. They had over 250 exhibitors and 100 startups just on the expo floor. It was jam-packed full of innovation and leading IoT businesses. They had an attendance of over 10,000 people and over 300 global speakers. It was literally impossible to go to everything. But my aching feet will tell you, it was worth every step.
For those who aren't familiar, the Internet of Things is the concept of connecting anything that runs on electricity, and even some things that normally don't, to the Internet. This includes everything you can think of, and I mean everything. It can also include individual components of machines, such as the jet engine of an airplane. However, the Internet of Things is about more than just connecting things to the Internet. It's about creating smart things, increasing automation and autonomy. If you're familiar with smart homes, the concept is similar, but on a larger scale. Some of the more outlandish devices that have been invented include an umbrella that reminds you not to leave it behind.
Whoa. Whoa. Okay, hold up. An umbrella that tells you, "Don't leave me." How does that work? Where are we going, Preston? You need me. No, but umbrella, I don't. It's sunny outside. But the weather could change. Don't leave me here. It's cold in this umbrella holder. Yeah, you know what? I'll just stick to good old-fashioned oversized leaves, like Totoro. Thank you.
As I was saying, also, There's a toothbrush that films the inside of your mouth with a camera, and even a tampon that reminds you when it's time for a change.
Wait, what? You're serious? A tampon that tells you it needs to be changed? Okay, I'd like to believe that the world doesn't need a smart tampon. And how does it remind you? Does it go off in the middle? Does it go off in the middle of a meeting, announcing in a loud voice, "Time to change"? Hopefully, if it does, it'll be when the boss is asking for suggestions. I'm sorry. It's wow, just wow.
Moving on, IHS Market estimates that there are currently 17 billion devices connected to the internet, twice as many as the number of humans on the Earth. What? Nothing to interject?
No, not this time. I mean, I'm already fired, so... So let me ask you, what is an internet full of things actually good for?
Well, some of the current and prospective applications of an internet full of things are, for instance, monitoring vibrations and material conditions in buildings and bridges so that you can assure structural integrity. You can also do forest fire prevention. This time it won't be just Smokey fighting the good fight. We'll be able to monitor combustion gases and preemptive fire conditions to define alert zones. You can also detect waste leakage of factories in rivers. You can detect liquid in warehouses and sensitive building grounds to prevent breakdowns and corrosion. And even your refrigerator is going to be able to tell your shopping cart which items are missing. And then your shopping cart can show you where they are. Warky, what were some of the exhibits at the convention that stood out to you?
Well, there were so many incredible displays there. Exhibits that stood out to me were definitely the Samsung booth. They had a Vir Zoom. Vir Zoom was showcasing its VR capabilities, utilizing the Samsung Gear VR. Now, I've already used Vir Zoom on the PlayStation VR, so to see it with the Samsung Gear was actually really cool. Experience-wise, the PS4 and the Gear VR, well, they're comparable in graphics and frame rate. Though, I think the PlayStation version may be better, but that's just because it's a dedicated machine. The demo I got to play was a game where you ride a Pegasus and collect targets like fruit or whatnot. It was a lot of fun to ride a Pegasus, but that could be just because I like flying on winged creatures. However, depending on which phone you use with the Gear VR, it could change things, such as resolution, speed, time before the phone gets hot, things like that. Still though, it was a stunning display. It's also very easy to lose yourself on the exercise bike that helps you get through the game, which for a larger person, me, was wonderful. I can't wait to see what others may come up with for the unit though, because the company is also giving away a free SDK, which is a software development kit, to help create games for the unit. I also really enjoyed the fact that Google Maps and Thermopylae were there, partnering up to bring us an even better Google Maps experience. Now, Preston, you got to speak a little more in depth with the representative there. What were your thoughts on it?
It was really interesting to see their partnership and how it affected the Google Maps app. They're using proximity to known Wi-Fi hotspot locations in order to be able to pinpoint your exact location, even when you don't have a mobile signal. This could be extremely useful for when delivering groceries to, say, the Caves of the Mole People, or New Jersey.
To a lesser extent. I also saw at the Gadgeon booth a biometric heart monitor. This was really cool to me. I know that this innovation of real-time diagnostics would be a huge help in the medical and caretaking communities. I also would think that athletes would love this, mostly because it could warn you from overexerting yourself, or if something were to happen with, say, your heart, doctors would be able to treat you immediately because the diagnostics would already be available to the medical staff.
That's a very good point. To elaborate a little, Gadgeon is one of the companies that creates the network hardware and provides the cloud services to enable internet connectivity. The biometric monitor will use this to report important information to your doctor and even to immediately notify emergency services if needed.
Can't wait to take advantage of that one. All in all, the future is definitely here. And the Internet of Things World Conference really was an amazing time with a lot to look forward to in the future. If you ever get a chance to go, well, I highly recommend you going.
Me too.
Not only was it educational, it was fun. Anyway, this is Warky and Preston reporting for User Friendly.
Welcome back to User Friendly. A lot of great information there this week, and join us online. Let us know what you think, and please ask your questions. Facebook, Twitter, One User Friendly, follow us. Get involved in the conversation. Userfriendlyshow.com is our website. There's a link there to contact anybody that you've heard on the show today. Ask your questions. Submit your story ideas. Next week on User Friendly, we have a very interesting look back coming up. The show's been on the air now for 4 years, and we've covered a lot of things. And a lot of technology that when we covered it was brand new is now considered to be legacy. We're going to see where some of that went, some of the times that we've had on the shows in the past couple of years. Check it out next week, and we look forward to hearing back from you. This is User Friendly, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User Friendly is copyright 2017, User Friendly Media Group, Inc., all rights reserved. Music used under license. Opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of User Friendly Media Group, Inc., or this station.